The clean energy jobs in Pennsylvania are 8 times greater than gas jobs. So the Democratic Party, big oil, the Republican Party, they're all lying to us. All when Kamala Harris says she needs to back fracking because she can't win Pennsylvania without supporting fracking, it's 0.2% of jobs.
Herzlich willkommen bei What's Left, dem linken Podcast zur US-Wahl. Eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Mein Name ist Lukas Hermsmeier, ich arbeite als freier Journalist in New York und ich werde bis November mit verschiedenen Gästen über die dringendsten Themen dieses Landes sprechen. Erst Hurricane Helene, dann Hurricane Milton. Der Klimawandel war in den vergangenen Wochen in den USA besonders deutlich zu spüren. Über 250 Menschen starben dabei. Die betroffenen Communities im Süden des Landes werden mit den Konsequenzen noch jahrelang leben müssen. Im Wahlkampf allerdings kommt die Erderhitzung kaum vor. Wenn überhaupt, verbreitet Donald Trump Lügen. Kamala Harris schlägt zwar ein paar Maßnahmen vor, aber versucht das Thema im Großen und Ganzen zu umgehen. Die Verdrängungsarbeit ist enorm. Aber natürlich gilt das nicht für alle. Mein heutiger Gast ist Elise Joshi, eine 22-jährige Klimaaktivistin aus Kalifornien, die eine Organisation namens Gen Z for Change leitet. Die Gruppe benutzt vor allem digitale Tools, um progressive Bewegungen zu unterstützen. Und das in verschiedenen politischen Bereichen, zum Beispiel im Kampf für Abtreibungsrechte oder auch in Solidarität mit streikenden ArbeiterInnen. Ich wollte von Elise wissen, was sie erwartet, sollte Harris die Wahl gewinnen, und was ein Sieg von Trump fürs Klima bedeuten würde. Wir haben auch darüber gesprochen, welche Taktiken der Bewegung sie für effektiv hält, welche Prioritäten sie sich wünscht. Und über die Gleichzeitigkeit der Krisen, mit der ihre Generation aufgewachsen ist. Hier kommt Elise Joshi. Hi Elise, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Elise, I feel like almost everyone right now, including myself, is going a little bit nuts so close to the election. I was wondering, how are you?
Anxious, and at the same time, just trying to tell myself there's only so much I can control, and that's pretty little, actually.
Mm. Do you have a gut feeling who is going to win?
Honestly, no. I'm a poll person, even though I know polls can be wrong, and it's just a toss-up. It just feels like it could go either way, and I think that's where the anxiety comes from.
Yeah, no, totally. So the topic of our conversation today is climate protection, the climate movement, your climate activism. But before we talk about that, I would like to address the stakes of this election, right?
Yeah.
In very general terms, what would it mean for the climate if Trump wins? What would you say?
Well, it really comes down to state and local importance. And I don't want to just say it's all over, but international collaboration, you know, is that much harder. He pulled out of the Paris Agreement. Not that the Paris Agreement is enough, but just some semblance of international collaboration on how we combat this crisis immediately is eliminated. He will roll back environmental regulations and the Inflation Reduction Act and any of the good things that has come out of the Biden-Harris administration on climate, which, of course, is not enough to limit to 1.5 degrees of warming, clearly. But yet it's still a rollback of what we have received. He promises to drill, baby, drill, and extract as much on public lands as possible. We know that his Department of Interior will approve any and all permits, and there's really no such thing as an environmental impact statement under a Trump presidency. They won't take that seriously. And, you know, even when I say this, I understand that we've been doing that under a Biden-Harris presidency, but to the extent that Donald Trump will, I think I can't even predict how bad that will be, and we will be on defense constantly.
Mm. But you wouldn't be as pessimistic as, let's say, Bernie Sanders, who put out a video yesterday.
Saw that.
Who said if Trump wins, the struggle against climate change is over. You wouldn't share that statement?
No, I did. I remember seeing that and being really disappointed, because what good is it to say we should give up on climate because somebody is in office. I mean, for one, the United States is one country of many around the world that needs to decarbonize. And two, a president is only, you know, as powerful as the powers that they're given. And I truly believe on local and state level, there's a lot that we can do. It's the states that set clean energy targets. It's the cities that set transportation policies and set zoning laws for mining, drilling, fracking, for housing. And we can truly combat so much of the effects of climate change through the powers of the regional governments. And I don't want to just say it doesn't matter, because it absolutely does. But for Bernie to say that it's over, I would have to disagree.
So you're against this kind of like alarmist approach in general? You don't think it's productive? Because I would assume his only intention is to like bring people to vote, right?
Of course. I understand the intention. But for one, I don't think it's accurate. And two, I don't think it's productive. At the end of the day, it is a toss-up, and we have to be careful with our words, and that if Donald Trump does win, we don't want young people to just say, you know, I give up. And in addition to that, we have to acknowledge that every degree of warming matters. You know, what 4 degrees is exponentially worse than 3.5 at the end of the century. And so to say it's over and implies that there is a winning and a losing, where I would instead argue that there is a sliding scale of how bad this can be, and we just need to be fighting back against every single tiny degree of warming.
What would it mean for the climate if Kamala Harris wins?
That is where it's all open. Status quo is what that means for the climate. I don't think that Kamala Harris is even arguing herself that she's going to be anything different than business as usual. With who she's campaigning with, how she's messaging, how little she's messaging about climate. I would assume that it will be record oil extraction on public lands, oil production on public lands, in the same way that Joe Biden had. She is bragging about how the Inflation Reduction Act is allowing for more fracking on public lands. Like, that is her messaging for the largest climate bill in U.S. history. Mm. And I can't imagine that it would be anything more than the status quo. And with that, I also emphasize the importance of organizing on the national level and organizing in our local governments, because it's not a guarantee that we combat the climate crisis with the boldness that it deserves under Kamala Harris' presidency.
Mm. In August, you were part of a call called Progressives for Harris. So I assume you are voting for her. How do you feel about voting for her? Is that a big compromise?
Yes. Yeah, so Gen Z for Change endorsed Kamala on the day that she was announced to be the new nominee for the Democratic Party. It was twofold. I would say it was both an endorsement of the decision for Biden to step out of the race, and then two, an endorsement of, okay, we wanted this to happen, and we will work to defeat Donald Trump another time. With that said, I have been taking all opportunities that I can to speak to a larger audience about what is needed to win this election. Progressives for Harris was early on in her campaign, her very short campaign at that, where I wanted to use that platform to show what is needed to earn the vote of young people. You know, bold policy, bold comprehensive climate policy, tackling the rent crisis, tackling the cost of living crisis at large, with progressive populist economic policies that will actually bring people to the polls because they are excited about the things that you're championing. And I wanted to acknowledge that that's how you win. You win by good policy, not, you know, flip-flopping on issues and appearing untrustworthy. And, you know, it's with a lot of sadness that a week before the election, she has not embraced that campaign strategy. But with regard to Gen Z for Change's overall electoral strategy, it's been really important for me to just take all opportunities to put forth the progressive agenda that's needed beyond an election, but also can win you an election. Yeah, and I'm looking back with not regret, but just disappointment.
The group you mentioned and that you are leading as the executive director,
yes.
Gen Z for Change, I have several questions about, obviously, later. Just talking about this election campaign, is the group still involved in canvassing, or is that not part of Gen Z for Change's work right now?
Right now, it's we're doing a lot of comparisons of candidates. Donald Trump is doing a lot of, how do I say this politically correct?
You don't have to.
Nazi type language and rhetoric.
I think that is politically correct.
You know, we're highlighting every single vile thing that him and his comrades are saying, and highlighting that we don't want this guy anywhere near the White House. We also partnered with March for Our Lives, Sunrise Movement, United We Dream to knock on doors in Arizona. That was one collaboration opportunity where we had a couple creators come and talk about the importance of young people knocking on doors and volunteering, not simply for Kamala Harris, but also for the abortion ballot initiative there, among other propositions. So that's been part of our strategy. But at large with our content, we've been doing a lot of comparisons between the candidates, highlighting what Project 2025 is and what it means for your. If you're interested in unionizing your workplace, what does that entail? If you're interested in combating the climate crisis, what does that entail? Issue by issue, immigration is a big one for us, especially with Donald Trump's rhetoric and proposals. So, yeah, a lot of candidate comparisons. Yeah, that's the gist.
Yeah. If we only look at the last several weeks and look at the hurricane season that has been so disastrous,
yeah.
Two hurricanes causing so many deaths. We saw both candidates, Trump and Harris, like visiting damaged areas, right? What were you thinking when you saw that, while at the same time the issue of the climate catastrophe has been playing such a small role
yeah.
in this election campaign? What do you make out of that?
Yeah, I was really hoping for a climate town hall where Kamala Harris could answer questions of maybe specifically young people across demographics and talk about how the climate crisis is here. It's right in front of us. It's affecting people and what she's going to do about it. And, you know, that didn't happen. I'm just shocked with one of the most devastating hurricanes we've seen in a long time. Be treated as simply that, you know, a natural disaster, even though it's not so natural. And at the same time, Republicans are, you know, spreading misinformation, disinformation across social media about how FEMA is not there, about how they're implying that Jews are controlling the weather. Marjorie Taylor Greene was making some insinuations at that. And so it's just, you still see the comparisons between the candidates of how vile the Republican Party has become and has always been. Their mask off now, but at the same time, the Democratic Party doesn't feel like they can be bold enough to just say, "I'm actually going to fight for you. I'm going to make sure that the big oil is held accountable. I'm going to Yeah, while I understand that the Republicans are just absolutely insane at this point, I'm disappointed that Hurricane Helene didn't result in a big policy proposal or messaging campaign from the Harris administration. That was surprising to me because if there was a school shooting, it's about the grief and how the grief is tied to gun violence, and climate change hasn't resulted in that quite yet.
Although I would see also comparisons, right? Like there is like a symbolic gesture when it comes to school shootings, when it comes to hurricanes, people like politicians turn up and then don't really change their politics, right?
Yeah. I think Democrats try a little harder at making it slightly political with shootings, with I don't, maybe they're worried that being too political will make them look bad. But at the same time, I got content on TikTok from young people from Asheville saying, I experienced not just a natural disaster, but the climate crisis. They are naming it, they're grieving, and they are mad at how big oil and billionaires have caused this crisis. And, you know, the climate crisis, you're always learning about it, but when it's right in front of your door, the anger really intensifies. And, you know, if young people from Asheville can make that comparison in that moment, I think that Kamala Harris can too.
Do you feel like if she wins and once she is in office, then that some space will open to push her in a good direction?
Yeah, I expect pushing. I should hope that any of the people saying, oh, you people criticizing her right now, you know, it's not the right time. Well, after the election, I would hope that that's when we all show up and demand everything that we deserve. And beyond those folks, like all the organizers we are constantly working with, the folks that I was mentioning earlier, we will definitely be advocating for rent caps that she said she would do on the campaign trail, and for any of the, you know, somewhat bolder economic policies that she's been championing. We're going to really target that, and then, you know, demand even more, of course. But at the same time, I've been realizing lately that leverage is really lost. The left needs to be building power, and right now, that it seems that the Democratic Party at large doesn't feel like the left can ever hold them accountable, and so they won't. What's the reason to listen? And I interrupted the White House press secretary last year, and one of the things that I said in regards to their climate policy is, excuse me for interrupting, but asking nicely hasn't worked. And I believe that that's true. Asking nicely hasn't worked, and we shouldn't expect it to. And so it's really important that when we say, like, pushing her, what tactics are we using? Because if it's just simply doing the same thing over again, marching in the streets with some cute signs saying there isn't a planet B, you know, save the earth, you know, that's not going to work. And that, you know, trying the same tactics over and over and expecting a different result is insanity. And we have to maybe reflect and internalize what some strategies that we can try that will actually be effective at forcing demands rather than hoping when we, you know, send an email asking nicely that they'll do it.
What would you say is the way forward? What kind of organizing strategies do you see being most effective?
Yeah, really, over the last few years, it's become apparent to me that it's labor and tenant power. That it, rather than, like I said, marching in the street with permits from the police to be able to do that, and asking nicely that it's cute. I think there's a purpose for it. I don't want to say that we should just never ever do that, but coupled with it is actual leverage, collective action through the power of your labor and withholding it with your colleagues, and demanding better from safer working conditions, livable wages from your boss. That is how you win. And you know, parallel to that is tenant power. Kansas City tenants are on strike, and it's really exciting to see because they won over $1 million in repairs for the mold that's in their building, things that are just haven't been working, and their landlords haven't been listening for years. And suddenly, after 25 days of being on rent strike, they won $1 million plus to finally repair those things. And so that's how we win. And that's why, you know, Bernie Sanders doesn't have quite the right approach when he's saying that it's all over when, you know, a president wins or loses, because we actually can win bigger if we just work together and withhold our rent, withhold our labor, and demand better from the people who are, you know, providing us housing. You know, that's a controversial statement, but, you know, and providing us jobs. You know, we can leverage our power better, and we we're doing that. That's being seen across the country, and it's escalating. You know, since 2022, we're seeing record unionization rates, and I just want to be part of that work and supporting it.
So every climate activist should join a union.
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Simple answer.
And if we talk about it more concretely, we have seen the United Auto Workers, for example, yeah. a big union, being almost militant in the last few yeah. years, and being very active when it comes to a just transition. Could you describe that a little bit more in detail? Because I think that gives some idea how the collaboration between the climate movement and old unions could work. Like what do you see as the path there?
Yeah, so of course there's bridges to be made on both the labor movement and the climate movement on understanding each other's needs. I will say that I saw the UAW strike as an olive branch extended from the labor movement, where they could have just said, hey, the transition to EVs is really uncertain. We cannot guarantee any of these jobs are for battery manufacturing, for actually making the EV itself, is going to be a union job, is going to be safe. So we're just going to, we're going to insist that all these jobs need to stay in to be manufacturing gas jobs. Screw the climate movement. You know, we need to secure our a future for ourselves. And they didn't do that. They said, we don't want the transition to EVs to be a race to the bottom. We want to be part of the fight to make sure that this necessary transition is one that has good union jobs. And knowing that they did that and won, that there are going to be battery workers, EV workers that are under the union contract, is just proof of the necessity to merge these movements together. And I truly believe that if we're going to decarbonize every sector of the economy, there's no way we do that without workers. It is just fundamentally impossible. And, you know, I was just in Nevada all of last week, traveling and seeing lithium mines in Nevada, and the proposed ones, because there's only one right now. But just in Nevada alone, it could bring us to number two of the United States to number two in lithium mining in the entire world. And, you know, I went there with one of UAW workers who are on the assembly line making EV Hummers that do not believe that EV Hummers are the future of our climate policy. Looking at this together and how extractive even our climate policy is on our planet. And yeah, workers don't live in a vacuum. They understand that we have to combat this crisis. We have to do it right. And part of doing it right is centering workers, indigenous communities, frontline communities at large. And yeah, just time and time again, it's proven to me the necessity to center them.
And at the same time, I would assume that a union like the United Auto Workers is very unlikely calling for less production in general in the next years, right? While they are stressing the importance of a just transition and yeah. protected jobs, what is needed at large, like just less production in many fields, will not be a demand from that union. Do you see that being a crucial tension in the next years?
Certainly. And at the same time, when I was talking to these workers, they understood that. You know, and there's certain amount, again, that they don't live in a vacuum, that if we only, if our only solution to decarbonize the transportation sector is EVs, then we're going to have to mine so much more lithium. And the effect that has on the indigenous communities that we met with across Nevada is severe. And yeah, it's political education of people in the climate movement on the needs of labor or of the labor movement, but also political education of the labor movement on the impacts of environmental disaster on other frontline communities is necessary. And I really do believe that it's possible to bridge that understanding. And we will need EVs in the future. We will need smaller ones that don't require as much lithium. And I think that the leverage of a large union can start to demand that at some point, that we you know, transition from, you know, baby killing EV Hummers that require four times more lithium than a sedan, focus on those smaller EVs. But yeah, I really do think that when you talk to workers, they understand. And I couldn't tell you the internal politics of a massive union like UAW, but I do think it's possible after talking to, you know, individual UAW workers.
Ich möchte an dieser Stelle eine Aussage von Elise Joshi herausgreifen. Als es um die Zukunft der Klimabewegung ging, sagte sie ziemlich entschlossen, dass das Wichtigste ein Zusammenschluss mit der Gewerkschafts- und Mietenbewegung sei. Sie will also, dass KlimaaktivistInnen sich dort organisieren, wo es wirkliche Druckmittel und Machthebel gibt. Mit anderen Worten, nicht noch eine Demo, lass uns lieber richtig streiken. In der zweiten Hälfte unseres Gespräches geht es unter anderem um die konkrete Arbeit ihrer Initiative Gen Z for Change und um die Lügen des Klimadiskurses. Der What's Left Podcast zu den US-Wahlen ist eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung What's und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Beide Redaktionen haben Personal und Zeit investiert. Finanziert wird der Podcast vom Recherchierfonds ProWatts. Wenn Sie mithelfen wollen, dass Projekte dieser Art auch in Zukunft umgesetzt werden können, spenden Sie auf prowatts.ch und abonnieren Sie eine oder gleich beide Zeitungen. If we look at the climate movement as a whole in the last years, there have been different groups being pretty dominant, right? Sunrise Movement, and then there has been the indigenous-led struggle against pipelines. There has been in the last one or two years a group called Climate Defiance doing more actions. Do you see these kind of actions also valuable, or do you think that is more a distraction given what you just said, that we actually have to go into unions, we have to like combine labor struggles with the climate struggle? Do you see the very dramatic performances of Climate Defiance still useful?
Yeah, I think it's everything, you know, and similar to Climate Defiance, I'd say Just Stop Oil might be the UK's version of Climate Defiance in a way of a little bit more public facing call outs to big oil and politicians that are backed by big oil. And
in Germany, that was the last generation, that group, or is still the last generation that did certain actions.
Yeah. Like. And we're seeing that pop up. And the fact that two young climate activists are getting 2 to 3 year sentences in prison for the tomato soup painting.
Yeah, it's wild.
Protest is proof that of the extent that the state will go to protect big oil. And I mean, that repression proves what they're doing is causing a ruckus to the big oil, you know, enterprise. And I don't want to say that's the only tactic that should be used. Absolutely not. And maybe not, you know, the opportunity cost. I would encourage more young people to be part of, you know, collective power through tenant and labor work. But at the same time, that's proof that, you know, it's pissing them off if they're going to be thrown in prison for something like that for years. So, yeah, I see a purpose. I don't want to just say, like, no to this, no to that. It's really about everything. But I do want to encourage young people to be part of more a leverage-based approach. Mm.
Do you see a tension, though, between what you have been describing as this approach to, like, win over labor for the climate movement, win over masses against certain actions that at least like risk to alienate the masses of people? I remember in Germany, a big discourse around when this group I mentioned did these actions to like block freeways, right? It did obviously cause or get the attention it wanted, but also many, many just normal average people who wanted to get home were really annoyed and you didn't win them over. And I'm very ambivalent about their tactics, but I definitely see the risk of alienating the people you actually want to convince.
Absolutely. I've been reading a bit of Black Panther Party history, and the idea of when they transitioned to the survival programs and became the Black Panther Party and not just the Black Panther Party of self-defense was realizing when the police repressed against the original movement, when they simply armed themselves, they didn't really emphasize the survival programs, that it was the police and the state versus the Black Panther Party, not the police and the state versus the Black community. And they wanted instead, through the survival programs, to meet the needs that the state will not provide the Black community. And that when inevitably the state represses against free breakfast programs, prison busing programs, sickle cell anemia tests, that it will be the Black community versus the state. And that heightens the level of consciousness of the entire community and realizes that we have to build anew. And so I do think it's very important. And that's why I emphasize labor and tenant organizing a lot, is because you are building relationships with the people you are working with, living with, understanding what their needs are, and demanding better together. And I don't think that it doesn't have the same effect of a road blocking in terms of pissing off the community, because you're working together as a community to demand better from your bosses or landlords. I don't want to say again that we shouldn't be doing that. I blocked a freeway on a Palestine protest in San Francisco a couple of times. And, you know, there's a lot of honks. There's a lot of people that are really supportive, you know, happy to be stuck in traffic because they know it's a good cause. But yeah, I do see the importance of evolving our tactics into one that feels like it's centered in the people, centered in community.
Mm. Let's talk a little bit about your organizing work with Gen Z for Change, an organization that is doing different kind of works. Could you describe a little bit what the work is, what the pillars of the organization are, what tools you're using, please?
Yes. So we're a coalition of organizers, all Gen Z on our team, that leverage the power of code, content, creators to make tangible change on the ground, always working with the communities that we're making tools and content for, in order to, you know, confirm that that's the strategies they think is best. So we work across issue areas, a lot with unions, but also with to stop disastrous oil drilling projects, to make healthcare more transparent. Can dive into any issue area to give some examples. We have just the most talented people on the team in a variety of ways. We got software developers on the team that create easy to use tools that we then disseminate using social media for people at large to support unions. Yeah. So
what kind of tools are we talking about?
One example would be 48,000 Kroger's workers in Southern California were on strike, and Kroger was hiring temp hires to water down the effectiveness of the strike so they could, you know, keep the work running while, you know, workers are demanding better. And so somebody on strike DM'd us, emailed us, because they had seen our Starbucks campaigns and said, do you think you could flood this with false applications? So we found a number of temp applications online in Southern California, and Sean Wiggs built a tool allowing you to send automatically generated false applications, fake resume, fake name, everything.
To the company.
And to the company, and all these online applications.
Could you say a little bit about the company? Sorry, just describe the company to people who have not heard about it, please.
Yeah, Kroger, Albertson, they're a grocery company, and so they provide food. These workers were demanding more livable wages and a fair contract. And we took them all down, sent about 30,000 false applications using Twitter and TikTok, and educated people on what they were, you know, demanding, and then also allowed sending them to use this tool. And so we took down all the temp applications, and they got a contract a few weeks later. Hopefully in small sliver, in part to do with them not being able to fill in scabs during the strike. Yeah.
How
that type of work.
How have you been helping other struggles, other movements with your tools? Could you give me maybe one more example, please?
Sure. Yeah. So for reproductive rights, there's, after the Dobbs decision that struck down Roe v. Wade, we wanted to increase transparency for healthcare in this really dire time. And so there's these groups called crisis pregnancy centers that pretend that they have abortion providers in order to coerce women to not terminate their pregnancy when they come seeking help. So we worked with Jane's Due Process to develop a list that's accurate of crisis pregnancy centers that do not have abortion providers there. And again, developed a tool that sends automatic, accurate Yelp reviews under these CPCs, indicating that an abortion provider is not there. And that's true. sent tens of thousands, I believe 26,000 false applications using, again, content and the creators in our network. And Yelp initially disabled the reviews. And eventually we got in touch with someone who works on policy at Yelp, and I think he liked it. And now there are warning labels on crisis pregnancy centers on Yelp that do not have abortion providers there. And so it's a temporary solution to an action instigated by Gen Z for Change.
Mm-hmm.
Or permanent solution, yeah.
If we look at your generation in general, Gen Z for Change is obviously to some degree representing that, but how would you describe this generation? And I'm aware how big and tough that question is, because what are we talking about? Like, what class, what milieu, what part of that generation? But maybe when it comes to the material conditions of that generation, to specific events, how would you describe Gen Z? How is it different to other generations?
Yeah, I believe every generation has its anti-war moment, it seems, or has its moment demanding better from the government. And we've seen that time and time again. But the particular uniqueness of Gen Z is that we have grown up with in a polycrisis that is unprecedented, I would say. A climate crisis. We were born and raised in one. The war on terror. I'm born in July 2002, so I did not know 9/11. I just know the aftermath. And the rent crisis. You know, I was five, six during the housing bubble burst. And all Gen Z has known, and I would put millennials in that, is skyrocketing rents. And yeah, these just overlaying issues that have not been addressed by the people who control our society, billionaires, politicians backed by billionaires. And we have a unique sense of exhaustion and anger and frustration and grief from experiencing these overlaying issues and have them not be addressed. And I believe that that's the reason we're seeing the campus protests and Starbucks workers. Those are young baristas unionizing their workplaces, and Trader Joe's workers. I mean, young people really are entering the labor movement and at record rates. And yeah, that the reason is that we've only known this.
Mm. Basically, on every political issues, young Americans, so Americans of your generation, are more progressive than the average, right? Which is obviously, to some degree, very frustrating, because you don't see, as you were just describing yourself, being represented and helped by the elite and in classes who rule. But is there also some form of hope you have if you look at your generation being far more progressive, because these are the people that will govern at some point, or is that too far away?
I don't think we should expect that the world will be saved once Gen Z is in office. And I think that's important too, is I understand the one of a kind generation through all of these crises and why we are the way that we are. And at the same time, note that I didn't say that it's the fault of all the other generations. It's still the fault of billionaires and, you know, a society that operates for the ruling class. And intergenerational solidarity among working class people is still the tactic, and not, you know, screw all these past generations. Gen Z is just going to be in office and save the world. One, that'll be too late, like you said. And two, that's really, you know, demeaning to our movement elders that are alive and well and organizing, and we have a lot to learn from, you know. And I think the passion from young people is really amazing, and I think that our perspective absolutely needs to be considered. And at the same time, I have so much to learn. I am 22, and, you know, talking to people that have been doing this for decades is very important to me to like make sure I'm not repeating the same mistakes, or I'm evolving tactics based on what's been tried before.
Mm-hmm. There are a few Congress members you work with, you are in touch with, right? Like Rick Cesar and Jamal Bowman, Cori Bush.
Yeah.
Do you still see, or not still, but do you see a chance to change the Democratic Party within, from within? Or will it always be like a few members of Congress you are close with and feel allyship with, but that's it?
I think I'm... give me a second. It was really hard for me when Jamal Bowman lost.
He just lost his the primary this summer, so he will leave Congress in January after 4 years.
Correct.
Right? 2 years?
Correct.
4 years?
Correct. Four. And so he was probably the closest person in Congress to me, not just Bowman himself, but also his team. That's really amazing. His legislative director is now at UAW, ironically. And I think for me, watching AIPAC buy his race, and for context, AIPAC spent the most in congressional history on unseating Jamal Bowman, and spread ads lying about his character, lying about his voting record, and darkening his skin color. It was just a malicious campaign. And what I realized for me is, of course, I will back the people that I consider allies in Congress. The Homes Act by AOC is a social housing bill. I fully believe in social housing, green social housing, and that is a policy we should be championing and educating the masses on. And she has a unique ability to educate a really wide audience on important new ideas like social housing. And so there is an importance. And at the same time, there's an opportunity cost. And I believe that Cori Bush's race, her unseating by AIPAC, and then Jamal Bowman is a reminder for me that while I will support and, amplify the good work that's happening to demand a weapons embargo, to demand rent caps, to do all of this if Kamala Harris should win, I will spend most of my time building power in order to, when we make those demands, that they feel like they have to say yes because of the power that we've built externally. And they go hand in hand, I guess is my point, is that AOC's, Rashida Tlaib's, their power is dependent on our power outside. And they can't make wins on the inside without the leverage that we build with a powerful working class. We still have to build that.
Mm. If we think about the election one more time, the election campaign, I feel like so much of the discourse around climate protection is shaped by this idea that fossil fuels are a massive employer and green energy or green industries don't offer that many jobs. Why is that? Like, for example, in a crucial swing state like Pennsylvania, that is shaping the outcome of this, right? Like, people think if we have a transformation.
And it's a lie.
Could you speak about that lie? What is wrong with this idea?
Pennsylvania employ the clean energy jobs in Pennsylvania are 8 times greater than gas jobs. So the Democratic Party, big oil, the Republican Party, they're all lying to us. When Kamala Harris says she needs to back fracking because she can't win Pennsylvania without supporting fracking, it's 0.2% of jobs. I mean, and not to mention, I think the infantilization of people who are in these jobs, who live near these jobs, is also disappointing because, again, these workers don't live in a vacuum. Their kids have cancer. They have asthma, heart conditions. They know that fracking has pluses and minuses. It provides them a job, and they are themselves facing the health consequences of them as well. And so, yes, it's all a lie. Just purely on the economic standpoint, 8 times greater the clean energy jobs, and in part due to the Inflation Reduction Act that they signed. So if there's also a certain confusion of why they would not champion the thing that they implemented as, hey, we are creating an economy of the future right now through the Inflation Reduction Act. There are thousands of jobs in Pennsylvania that are directly tied to the grants that we've given in the last 2 years. But yeah, it's hilarious I'm doing their job for them.
To counter that propaganda, though, would you say it is even more important to emphasize something like a universal basic income? Like the people who lose, who actually going to lose their jobs, will be protected? Is that a crucial element?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely. A just transition is incredibly important. How, you know, this is not my expertise, but like what other industries are very replicable with the, you know, the jobs that fracking provides, and providing those, the necessary trainings to transition into to different industries. I do believe that fracking and clean energy can transition quite well. And if we make sure that those clean energy jobs are good and union with good benefits, good pay, then that's even more enticing. So yes, yeah, just transition is a necessary component.
Elise, in the end, I ask all my guests the same two questions. One, what do we talk about too much when it comes to, in your case, climate protection, the climate movement, the issue of this climate catastrophe?
EVs. Even though I love UAW, I love auto workers, mass transit, and building back our communities, and, you know, ones that are walkable, bikeable, enjoyable to stroll through, and not, you know, instead of arrive at instead of drive through. That's really the heart of this. And, you know, of course, I understand EVs are part of it, but the fact that it's the majority of the investments and the majority of the conversation around whether we're actually tackling the climate crisis or not is really disappointing, and proving that we're not doing enough.
And what do we not talk about enough? I mean, you already mentioned mass transportation, for example, right?
That's for one. Another is how we coordinate, collaborate, and center Indigenous communities that are at the heart of the climate movement around the world. And if we sideline Indigenous communities to mine the lithium that we need to put in the batteries for EVs, we're creating and replicating the same problems that the fossil fuel industry created. And ensuring that Indigenous sovereignty is at the core of our climate policy is how we're going to win. And I promise you, you're not saving the world if you're sidelining these communities.
Elise, thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
Wir reden zu viel über Elektrofahrzeuge, sagt Elise Joshi. Wir reden zu wenig über den Ausbau des öffentlichen Verkehrs. Und wir werden in Sachen Klimaschutz nur dann wirklich weiterkommen, wenn wir die Frontline-Communities in den Mittelpunkt stellen, also die Menschen, die am direktesten von der fossilen Wirtschaft und ihren Auswirkungen betroffen sind. Mich hat besonders überzeugt, wie klar Elise in ihrer Klassenanalyse ist. Nicht alle Boomer sind schuld, nicht alle Kids sind die Rettung. Die Frage ist, wer Macht hat und wer nicht, für wen Politik gemacht wird und für wen nicht. Das war die letzte Podcast-Episode vor der Wahl. In der kommenden Woche wird es einen Abschluss geben, in dem wir die Ergebnisse der Wahl bewerten und nach vorne schauen. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Dieser Podcast ist eine Koproduktion von der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik, finanziert durch den WOTS Recherchierfonds. Am Podcast beteiligt sind Ua Gültekin, Kaspar Surber, Jan-Ole Arps, Payam Masumi, Helen Derik und Lukas Hermsmeier.